Okay, well, John's given us the high-resolution picture of some of these galactic binaries. I'm going to continue the theme of galactic binaries, but I'm going to look on a much kind of broader bandcast at the spectra and what these can tell us. And then I'll try and bring everything together and do a bit of a synthesis, try and pull broad bandpass stuff, QPO stuff, and ion lines together at the end. Okay, here we go. This, I presume, is a laser pointer. Good. Okay, so the idea is that we're going to test some of these accretion disk theories by actually going to the observations and having a look at accretion disks around black holes. And of course, we could go look at black holes. We could look at the supermassive ones that lurk in the centers of active galaxies, or we could look at the ones that power the ultra-luminous X-ray sources we see in other galaxies, or we could look at the galactic black holes as well. And because black holes are very simple objects, we're just moving the mass around, the accretion flow should scale. So what we learn about accretion in one set of objects should carry over to all of them. So I'm going to start with the galactic binary systems, because there we've got a lot of data. And they vary on very useful timescales, from milliseconds to years. So here are some RXDE, All-Sky Monitor, light curves. This is 7 years along the bottom. They're inherently very variable objects. And so this gives us observational templates of how the accretion flow varies as a function of what should be the physical determining parameter, the ratio of the luminosity to the Eddington luminosity. And they're all more or less the same mass. We get this nice set of 10 solar mass-ish black holes, give or take a factor of two. We're astronomers, we don't care. And we can use these to build up an observational picture of what accretion flows do. So when you think about accretion flows, the first thing that springs to mind is a standard Shakura-Sunyaev disk, where you've got differential rotation giving rise to heat. Well, we now know that that leap, differential rotation to heat, is actually a very complicated magnetic dynamo that's going on in the disk. But nonetheless, if you get heat, if you have enough material that emission thermalizes, then you get some luminosity that's proportional to 2 to the 4. It's what thermal stuff does. Because the gravitational energy you have to tap is increasing inwards, and because the area over which you're dissipating it decreases inwards, the temperature goes up quite sharply inwards. And then you've got this general relativistic prediction. There should be a last stable orbit if what you're dealing with is test particles. That's going to determine the maximum temperature that you see from the disk. And that, of course, depends on the spin of the black hole. The faster you spin the black hole, if your disk is co-rotating, and we all believe in co-rotating disks, then it can get in a lot closer. So you go from something like this, the Schwarzschild, to this, to an extreme Kerr black hole. And you can work out these expected maximum temperature that you would see from the disk. And for Eddington accretion onto one of these 10 solar mass black holes, it comes out to be about 1 keV or 10 to the 7 Kelvin. So you go and look at what you see, armed with this picture, and what you see is a mess. This is one black hole on 4 different days. One black hole. It has not changed its mass, it has not changed its inclination. It has changed its mass accretion rate. I always plot nu f nu because then peaks in this diagram shows you where the power output peaks. And what a mess. Okay, with XDE, we've now got lots and lots and lots and lots of data. We don't have to get everything out of one snapshot anymore. If you look at these, you can see that some of them do actually bear a startling resemblance to those ideas of a Shakura-Sunyaev disk. Look at this one, the red line. Okay? That really looks amazingly like a disk, thermal emission. Okay, it's got some very weak hard energy tail out here, but plainly that's 1% of the power. We're astronomers, sweep that under the carpet, that's not a problem. Okay, let's go to the green one as well. It's still looking quite remarkably like a disk down here. Okay, this is now something more like 15% of the power. We might start getting worried about that lump under the carpet. But those two spectra look very similar to those ideas of a Shikura-Sunyaev disk. The rest of them do not. You've got this magenta line. This is often called the very high state or the steep power law state. It doesn't really look like a disk at all. There's no separate disk component. It's strongly Comptonized out into this tail. But on a new FNU plot, you can see that it's peaking around about 1 keV. It kind of understands the energy the disk would have had if the disk had been there without being very strongly Comptonized. So that state does look like it knows something about a disk as well. The really strange one is this so-called low hard state, which is peaking at energies 100 times higher than it should, and it just looks nothing like a disk. Okay, so that's the sort of variety we have to pick from. Let's start out picking the easy ones. We'll get complicated later, but let's do the easy things first. So let's only pick the ones that look like a disk, where that power law tail is less than 10, 15% of the total volumetric luminosity. And when you do that, you can go and fit these spectra. You fit them with disk models, and you get this maximum temperature of the disk, and you get the luminosity of the disk. And because these are galactic black holes, we know more or less distance, mass, inclination, etc. So we can convert fluxes to luminosities. And then we can plot L over LED of this disk luminosity, and we can plot the temperature, the maximum temperature in this disky component, and the black and red points are the data. The cyan points are giving you an indication of the uncertainties in mass, distance, and inclination, what they do to the luminosity, our uncertainty on the luminosity determination. This straight line is the relationship between the disk luminosity and temperature you'd expect for a Schwarzschild no-spin black hole. Well, firstly, the fact that you see luminosity is proportional to T to the 4 tells you that there's some sort of constant radius in this problem. And the only constant radius I can think of that could stay constant over two orders of magnitude change in disk luminosity is the innermost stable orbit. But it's not just proportional to T to the 4. Again, this proportionality constant can give you that innermost radius size. And this is what you'd get for 6m for a equals 0, this line. This is how far you'd move it if you were dealing with maximal care. And it's not just that one object. This is a fairly well-known microquasar. Let's go look at another object. Here's another. All the symbols have the same meaning as before. Here's the data. Here's the error range on luminosity. Here's zero spin. Here's maximal spin. So low to moderate spin. Daniel. The red symbols are ones where the power law is between 5 and 15% of the total volumetric. The black symbols are where it's less than 5%. So it's just giving you a feeling for how much power law you've got, whether it's tiny or small. Here's another. This is LMCX3. What we're seeing is the disk spectra really look like low to moderate spin, not extreme spin, nor extreme versions of higher dimensional brain world gravity. You can ask me about that afterwards if you want. You can even go play these games on the Wacko microquasar 1915, which does this dramatic, hideous variability in 50% of its data. Well, if you look at very high time resolution, you can find some spectra in 1915 that are dominated by the disk emission. It's a lot more fluffy here because it's much more absorbed, so there are good error ranges on the temperature determination, but still, again, you're finding low to moderate spin, not extreme spin. You don't need extreme spin to power a jet. Many of the ones I've shown you so far have been microquasars. You do not need extreme spin to power a jet. Low to moderate spin seems to be fine. Okay, well, you might say, well, you know, it shouldn't be that simple, you know. The vertical structure of an accretion disk, it's a complicated thing. Unless you change the mass accretion rate through the disk, you'll change its density, you'll change its vertical structure, there should be all sorts of correction factors that come on in there. Surely, disk spectra can't be this simple. Well, the best theoretical models say they can be. Shane Davies and Omar Blaze have been doing some new disk models which have metal opacity included to really work out the vertical ionization structure of the disk. And their models are shown here. Here's a zero spin model. Here's a spin of 0.7. And yesterday we actually took these data and tried to fit them all simultaneously, and we got a spin of 0.1, but that was the fitting stuff very quickly. So there really does seem to be some very good evidence that we see an innermost stable orbit. But all the MRI simulators tell us that there is no such thing. They tell us that the accretion flow doesn't behave like a test particle because this viscosity is a magnetic field. And magnetic fields connect material inside the plunging region to material in the disk. And that means we're not in test particle. It's not just gravity. There are magnetic fields as well. So here are some of their beautiful simulations. Here's the position of the last stable orbit for various spins, and here's their flow going straight through it without really seeing it. But the thing is, the observational data give us a clear signature of an innermost stable orbit. So what can be going on? Well, maybe it depends on the flow properties. These MRI simulations have been for fairly large scale height flows. If you have a large scale height flow, you can have a fairly large scale height to your magnetic field. You get to the last stable orbit. If you've got a large magnetic field scale height, it can really hang on into the plunging region, connect large distances, plunging region to disk. And you can have a lot of torque, maybe, at the last stable orbit, so you don't really see it. If instead you had a radiative MRI simulation with a geometrically thin disk, then the size scale of your magnetic field would be that big. And then you get to the last stable orbit, and you can connect that far into the plunging region. And that doesn't really do very much for you. So this is an argument by Ashfordy and Paczynski. And I'd love the MRI simulators to go simulate me a thin disk and see if it works. That's on my wish list at the end as well. Right, so let's move away. And let's now start to get the next level up in complexity. Let's go look at all the data. Let's no longer throw away the three quarters of the data that looked complicated but didn't look like a simple disk. Now let's just go and look at everything and see if we can make sense of the underlying pattern that we see. We couldn't do this before our XTE. We only had snapshot spectra. And if all you have is snapshot spectra, and you see this one day, this another day, this another day, and this another day, you're going to be very confused. So let's think about what we've got. There's an underlying pattern that you can see. Well, you probably can't see it in these data, but if you stare at enough of them, you can. And that's at high Eddington luminosities, you have typically rather soft spectra. They know something about the disk. Whereas at low luminosities, as fractions of Eddington, you see this bizarre non-disk-like spectrum, this low hard state spectrum. So what are we looking at? Well, those accretion disk models assumed that we had thermal plasma, assumed that the disk was optically thick enough that the energy thermalized. That's not necessarily true at low fractions of Eddington, because if the flow is not very dense, then you don't have many collisions and you don't necessarily thermalize. And instead, you can have a hot, optically thin, geometrically thick inner accretion flow, replacing the optically thick, geometrically thin disk. There are all sorts of ways of parameterizing this flow. You can have Compton cooling being dominant or advection being dominant. You can have inflows, outflows, convection, jets, you name it. It's probably an acronym in the literature, but there's some generically optically thin, geometrically thick, hot solution. And if it's hot plasma, then these hot electrons, can Compton upscatter any seed photons from a residual truncated disk further out. But because there aren't many of them, your Comptonized spectrum is always going to be hard. So you can make qualitative models based on these kind of geometrical arguments. You can say, okay, suppose what we're looking at is a truncated accretion disk with one of these funny complex flows in the middle. Suppose that's what we're looking at low mass accretion rates, where the flow isn't very dense, and we get this hard spectra. Then as we push the mass accretion rate up, then maybe this transition radius comes in, and so we get more seed photons from the disk, more Compton cooling, and a softer spectra, until the disk manages to get all the way into the last stable orbit, at which point the spectra are dominated by the disk, but we can get a little bit of a hard tail by having bits of magnetic reconnection bubbling up over the top of the disk. And then if we increase the amount of magnetic reconnection bubbling off the top of the disk, we increase the amount of Compton scattering, but because of the geometry, because there's copious seed photons from the disk, the spectrum's always fairly soft. And then if we really go for it and cover loads of the disk, then we can get a very strongly Comptonized spectrum, like the very high state. So what you can do is you can test these ideas by getting the RXTE archive and just going through as many black holes as you can lay your hands on. Now, you don't want to do detailed spectral fitting for each one because there are hundreds and hundreds of spectra in there. So instead, what we did was go and do some broadband colors and parameterize them in terms of rough spectral slope between 3 and 6 kV and rough measure of spectral slope between 6 and 16 kV. And then if you plot these spectral slopes against each other, the cyan points are all the galactic black holes we could lay our hands on at that time. And they all do the same thing. They start off here at low luminosities with hard power law-ish spectra, they soften, and then they go into one of these disk-dominated states, which is either a very clean-looking disk or a very Comptonized, dirty-looking disk. But I said we could make quantitative models as well as qualitative models, and that's what these lines are. These lines are interpreting those geometrical models in a fairly sophisticated Comptonization code and saying, okay, what happens if you push the disk in, if you increase the amount of seed photons? What happens to the Comptonizing electrons? What happens to their spectra? And then analyzing those in the same way and putting the models on the data. And you can see, you can really make quantitative as well as qualitative models for what's going on. So let's go have a bit of a look at some of our problem child spectra. Let's look at them in more detail. The very high state is one that we've talked about a lot as being a pretty difficult type of spectra. The problem is you've got a strong accretion disk spectrum and strong Comptonization, and then you really have to be very careful how you model things, and things do become model dependent. John was showing nicely in his talk how things change when you have a power law or whether you have a Comptonized spectrum. If you've got a disk spectrum and you think your hard tail is a power law, you'll get a very different amount of flux in your Comptonization at the seed photons than if you think it's a proper Comptonization model. And things really change about a lot. And so to illustrate that, I've got here the luminosity in the disk and the maximum disk temperature for one galactic black hole, XTEJ 1550. In the purple and orange are those disk-dominated states. And then blue and green are some of the more complicated states where this power law tail is quite important in the spectra. And you can see that some of these, if you fit them with just a disk spectrum and a power law spectrum, that some of these have much higher temperature than you'd expect, indicating much smaller radius, and some of them have much lower temperature than you'd expect, indicating much larger radius. And they're a mess. They're a complete mess. So what are we looking at in these spectra? Well, one of the problems is how you model this. This is what happens to those data if I use a Comptonization spectrum rather than a power law. Let me just flip between those two. Yeah, so as John was saying, things get very difficult when you start to look at these more complex spectra. But the ones that were dominated by disk spectra didn't move at all. They know what they're doing. It's these ones where you've got both disk and power law that life gets really very complicated. Okay? So that's one thing we can do, and that did tend to move all the data points closer to where you'd expect them to be. But when you look at the spectra, okay, we've got a lot of Comptonization here. There's a lot of photons here. Compton scattering conserves photon number. These photons came from somewhere, and they came from the disk. So we should actually be correcting our inferred disk luminosity for the photons that came from here, because we're thinking of a geometry like this. So when you do that, those points all move all over the place. Okay, so life's getting complicated. Let's just concentrate on, oh no, we won't do that yet. We've corrected for photon number, but the energy came from somewhere as well. And the energy of the corona presumably comes from the disk. What we're modeling here, we're saying the disk is unchanged by the fact that suddenly we've got so much energy in a corona. 50% of our energy is in this corona, and the disk didn't notice. That means we suddenly acquired energy from goodness knows where. That doesn't work. We believe in energy conservation. Let's concentrate on just a couple of spectra. This is what you'd infer if you think a miracle has occurred and the energy came from nowhere. This is what you'd infer if you think that the disk and corona are coupled, that there's a finite amount of energy from the gravitational field, that the disk responds to the fact that it grew a corona. If you have an energetic corona, that energy came from somewhere, it came from the disk, it's at the expense of the disk, it's a coupled system. Well, I hope I've convinced you that these very high state spectra are complicated beasts, that pulling temperatures and luminosities, as John was saying, out of these sorts of spectra is hard and somewhat model dependent. I had them here, I had them here. Okay. I never had them over here. I never had them in the region which would tell you that you were going down below whatever innermost stable orbit was defined by the disk-dominated states. Okay, so let's try and pull all this together because I'm running out of time. This is like an anatomy of an outburst. What are we looking at? Okay, when these go into their outbursts and they're generically transients, they come from very, very low luminosities. We understand something about disks going into outbursts. We understand something about the hydrogen ionization instability. We know that at very that when these are very dim, the disk is mainly out at large radii. We know that the hydrogen ionization outburst triggers most of the disk material moving in. So this fits very nicely in with these hot inner flow models, with the disk moving in as you trigger an outburst. And as you trigger the outburst, you get more and more mass coming in. So this gets somewhat brighter, the disk is coming in, the spectrum's getting softer, you get into these states where you've got a mess here, and then you finally get down to the last stable orbit, then you've got varying bits of magnetic reconnection over the disk. The nice thing about these models is you can tie in some of the QPO behaviors that you see. Both the inner disk radius and probably the size of this corona get smaller as you move the disk in. That gives you a very nice way of changing the low frequency QPO, having its frequency increase during the rise to outburst as is seen. You can also tie it in with the jet emission. But we know that down here we've got a steady, moderate speed jet. Then as you push the inner disk in, the jet goes faster. If you've done this really, if you're doing this outburst very quickly, then the slower jet from the quiescent stages gets caught up with by the faster jet, and Rob Bender's done some really nice work on how that can give you internal shocks, like a very scaled down gamma ray burst, and that can give you those bright flaring episodes of radio emission that you see. Okay, but as John Miller was saying, there are some flies in the ointment. Okay, this all seemed like a very nice, coherent, plausible tale, a very good picture that we can fit a lot of data in. But if it doesn't work for all the data, then we need to modify it. So what about the relativistic effects that he was talking about? Obviously, we get broader lines if the disk is closer in. So this predicts that we should get broad lines in the low hard state and broader lines as the spectrum softens. So this is a compilation of lines from galactic binaries that John Miller did. And it's very, very clear that these lines are not narrow. Life actually gets a bit tougher in active galaxies because you have the complex environment, you have the torus, you have the broad line region that will give you narrow components. But here, we're not in those sorts of situations. Clearly, these lines are not narrow. So, that's nice. And these broad lines, they're common in galactic binaries, and there are even some indications that the width of the line does increase as the spectrum softens. But there are some problems as well. Some of the extremely broad lines are in the same objects that the disk spectra we inferred low spin for. But if you have an extremely, extremely broad line, then you actually need the material to be going very, very fast, and you actually need high spin in order that the disk extends down that far into the gravitational potential. So this object, and this object, they were ones I showed you, that luminosity T to the 4 relation in the disk-dominated spectra, indicating low to moderate spin, whereas these lines, you require high spin. Now, what we're looking at here, they're mainly very high state or the sort of softest low hard states, sometimes called intermediate states. I'm sorry, the nomenclature is dire. So maybe what we're seeing is that in these very high states and low hard states, I drew it as a sort of larger scale height flow. Maybe what we're seeing is the MRI result that large scale height flow can extend further down into the gravitational potential. Maybe it's extending down below the last stable orbit that we were seeing from a geometrically thin disk. But I'd say there are still problems, and we need to address them. One of the problems is just the shape of the spectra. This hasn't come out too well, but there's data under here. This is a simultaneous ASCA XDE. There's also OSSI data out over here. And you just look at the shape of the spectra. This is one where there is certainly a broad residual in the spectrum at iron. And you look at the shape of this spectra. This is absorption corrected. So this is showing you the turnover for the seed photons. This is the thermal comptonization. This is a non-thermal tail. And the spectrum is smooth. there's no obvious jump between the disk and the Comptonizing region. That has to mean that the inner disk is covered by optically thick material. We can't see it. And it's hot, this material. Its temperature is roughly 10-20 KeV. It can't produce ion line. There's another one here in a sort of extreme intermediate state where we've sort of gone through the data in detail and said, okay, what is there? Plainly, it's broad. Plainly, you can interpret this as an extremely an extreme line with extreme emissivity, but you can also interpret it, let me go down here, as a broad line with normal emissivity with a bit of resonance absorption stuck on the blue end of the line. So, we're at a fabulous time in that we've finally got enough data to build and test accretion models. And that's new. We've even got three different ways of looking at the accretion flow. We've got the broadband spectra, we've got QPOs, we've got relativistic lines. So at some point, we're going to make them all give us the same story. And when we understand the accretion flow, we can test GR. And I think the fact that we're seeing an innermost stable orbit, we're seeing what looks like a Shakura-Sunyaev disk, tells us that corrections to general relativity, even at those very small distances from the black hole, are going to be smallish. So for the simulators, the MRI doesn't predict an innermost stable orbit, but we see one, so something's got to be wrong. Then when you go looking to more complex types of accretion flows, you see that it's not always a simple disk. You've got this tail. Life can get very complicated. The jet's related to the tail, not to extreme spin. Then when you get to these very high states, I think we're seeing strong evidence that the disk and corona are a coupled system. You grow a corona, you sucked the energy from the disk. You can get a consistent picture for the broadband spectral evolution, QPOs and jets, with this truncated inner disk model that where the disk moves in as you increase the luminosity. But that runs into some problems with occasional spectra of the broad lines. So maybe we need to start again. Or maybe there's complex absorption, perhaps a disk wind, that's slightly modifying the breadth of the line that we see. So I'll leave you with my wish list. That one's mine. Okay, questions?
Okay, I'll start in this end. Chris?
I have a comment and then a question. The comment is, I think it's a stretch to say that you've proven that you've seen the ISCO. I mean, the L goes as T to the fourth just shows that there is some similar pattern of emission on the disk, which scales as you change the disk. I mean, there's no telltale sign of the ISCO that I think you've seen. And then the question is, I remember Wei Sui presenting a very similar analysis to yours several years ago, comparing disk temperatures with predictions from disk, and he was coming to the opposite conclusion that you actually did require rapidly spinning black holes. So, what's changed?
I can't remember the details of that paper. What I would always be careful of is if there's more than 10 or 15% in that power law tail, then I would walk away from the disk spectra, because John showed how delicate they are to how you're determining the parameters of the Comptonizing tail. Where that tail is weak, then I think the results are very robust. If it's 10% of the flux, then if you model it as a Comptonized spectrum or a power law or anything, you'll get the same results for the disk. But as soon as that tail starts to become a significant fraction of the flux, then it's much more model dependent.
Related to the last question, when you try to, even if you are seeing a marginally stable orbit,
yeah.
The inference of black hole spin from a comparison of the temperature to the luminosity assumes that you know the distance, hole mass, the inclination, and the grayness or otherwise of the emission. And how well controlled are all of those parameters?
Right, let's go back to this picture here. Right, okay. So this is for one particular black hole where all the uncertainties, the maximum uncertainties in distance, inclination, mass, etc., are given by the cyan lines. That's the bound on the published uncertainties in distance, inclination, mass. The when we did some data fitting with the best currently available models for the disk structure, which have the vertical disk structure, which have metal opacity, so you can look at them at various inclinations, and hopefully it does it right insofar as those are the best models we have, then you get these lines for zero spin, this line for spin of 0.7. So even with all the uncertainties in mass, distance, inclination, these data don't really let you go past A of 0.7.
I think your continuum fits are really the odd man out. You neglected to mention spin constraints based on QPOs. If you assume only the most naive QPO models, and you just say that the highest frequency you see is the Keplerian frequency, then for instance 1550 requires spin at about 4 sigma. That's just the most naive models. Coupled models where you have a precession obviously require a spinning black hole, and models like the Abramovich model, which explain the 2 to 3 QPOs, require a much higher spin. So it's in fact these continuum fits which are the odd man out against QPOs and iron lines. But beyond that, I think there's a very simple explanation for why your fits are disparate, and that's just that the modeling you did was based on PCA spectra between 3 and 20 keV. There are 41 bins between 3 and 20 keV. Your model has 21 parameters. You've
it does
indeed. Disk block body plus thermal comptonization plus power law does indeed have 21
parameters. No, it's just disk block body and thermal comptonization.
Well, that might be true, but we can look it up. You could.
Yep.
Everyone in the room can look it up. It's 17
yep.
to 21, depending on which you fix.
Yep.
You've enforced the bias towards low temperature disks on the data with that model.
I would disagree. I would certainly, as you were sharing in your talk, when that power law becomes a significant fraction of the bolometric luminosity, then you can swing what you get in many ways. But for the very disk-dominated spectra, where you've got less than 10% of the power in the tail, then it's really very robust, and there isn't much you can do to it to swing things around. I'll just put that picture up and let people decide.
Eric, this is just a comment. Also, it goes back to the other talk. For fun, a student and I, Sean Hartnell, looked at iron line profiles from ADAFs, only what we did was put in a dense clumps tracing the flow, a small volume filling fraction, but a large covering fraction. And one can get very similar iron line profiles to the thin disk, except that they're a little bit less broad because you have pressure support, which is taking some of the angular momentum away. But it is perhaps interesting that so that would be something like the hard state, and such clumps were motivated by possible thermal instabilities that could produce dynamically cold material just for a short time that disappear and reappear and this kind of thing. Some of those kind of paradigms date back to Riess.
I had wondered about such models, but one of the problems I thought that came with those is that for these very high state spectra, where what you're seeing is this very smooth comptonization continuum with no clear separate disk component, then you can infer the parameters of that comptonizing medium. It's got to be optically thick. And so if, I mean, we're talking tower 2 or 3 here, and if you had blobs embedded in that drifting in, I didn't see how you could still see them underneath a tau of, how you could still get out any ion line from them underneath a tau of 2 to 3. Right, in the low hard state, then the optical depth of this comptonizing region is more like unity. So there you might well get some contribution from blobs, from illumination of blobs drifting in. But if they have low filling factor, then I think I'd also expect them to have low covering fraction. So I think I'd expect their contribution to be fairly small in terms of the total emission line that you see. Okay. Let me repeat the comment so that people could hear it. He was saying that it's possible to get a high covering fraction with a low filling fraction, maybe.
Next question. I would like to change the subject of discussion a little bit. I'm accustomed to hear during talks like that something about what causes the changes in the accretion rate to start with, and then...
Okay, I can answer that, because for the galactic binaries, they're generically unstable to the hydrogen ionization disk instability. So generically, you build up material in the disk, and it's fairly cool, and the viscosity is very low. Eventually, you build up enough of it that it goes above the hydrogen ionization point, and the whole material just kind of tips up, falls in flat.
So I kind of expected this answer, but so my question is, can you test that? I mean, with your data,
we had a go. Because XTE's rapid response, it could actually get on and follow some of these outbursts. And so we had a look at the rise to outburst of one of these transients, and tried to look and see whether the broadband spectra, in terms of the overall softness, obviously that's consistent with a lot of material moving in, with the spectrum softening during the rise to outburst. We had a go at looking at the relativistic ion lines and amount of reflection, but ionization becomes quite an issue. The disk is quite highly ionized, and life becomes more complicated. But certainly the data on the rise to outburst were consistent with the idea that the disk was moving in, that you were in a hydrogen ionization triggered instability.
But you wouldn't be saying that the entire state transition framework just simply depends on N-dot, do you?
No, because you see very clearly one of the reasons that there's been... it's been so hard to make sense of these spectra. It's because they're not one-to-one. It's not at one given luminosity you will see a given spectral shape. That's plainly a two-parameter family. Michael van der Klees had a very nice idea where he took running averages, I think, over 20 or 30 days, and that did seem to correlate one-to-one. That it seemed to be there's a long-term memory, like the kind of memory you'd get in a viscous accretion disk, which takes time to move it around. That there is a long-term memory in the system, and that is also contributing. The state of the disk at any point, it takes time to change it.
What's the radius of, what's the truncation radius in the low state? What's the best fit, say, for Cygnus X1 and JX? 3 to 9 minus 4.
Well, where? Cygnus X1 actually spends most of its time, it doesn't change very much because it's the one galactic black hole that doesn't get the hydrogen ionization instability because it has a high mass companion with a high mass transfer rate. So actually its mass accretion rate only changes by about a factor of 2. It just wobbles on this sort of edge.
Yeah, so what's the value of this radius?
I can't get you it because there's no clear disk-dominated spectra in Cygnus X1. But I... I would expect it goes from about 10 to 6 or 10 to 4 or whatever the spin of SIGX1 is. If there's no clear disk-dominated spectra, I'm not going to tell
you. We have one good example from XTEJ1118 because it located at a very high latitude, so the absorption were quite weak. In that case, we can determine the transition radius very precisely. And I think the value is approximately 300 Schwarzschild radii.
I'll take one more question on this side.
Assuming for the moment that the black holes are born with low spin and assuming something about their lifetimes and accretion rates, how quickly will it take for it to spin up to maximum?
Okay, well, low to moderate spin. There's been some work on gravitational waves that suggests that you would lose quite a lot of angular momentum during the collapse by gravitational waves. Maybe that would get you to 0.7, 0.6. You did expect it to be spun up. But to spin it up appreciably, you'd have to accrete the mass of the black hole. These are typically low-mass X-ray binaries, 10 solar masses here, one solar mass here. You don't have enough mass, even in a Hubble time, to spin this up appreciably through accretion. Andrew King's done a paper on this showing that for the galactic black holes, the spin distribution that you see pretty much has to reflect the birth evolution, the birth spin distribution, because you don't have enough mass in most systems to spin them up appreciably. Perhaps there's someone here who knows more about this than me.
Well, we've run out of time here, so let's convert our energy to a different room and thank the speaker one more time.